This is Brock and Salk.
Brock Huard is my hero.
What Brock Huard says?
No, he's not a friend.
Subscribe to receive every episode at Apple Podcasts or on Google Podcasts.
Ah, we stink, man.
Now, here are your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Salk.
No way!
This is so unfair. So unfair to ask us to come in and record this podcast, which you could be listening to at any time. Tuesday morning after the Mariners comeback win over the Astros. This is not right. This is just not right. My energy level's at like a 30 out of 10. But you could be listening to this in 2 or 3 days. The Mariners may have lost the last couple games to Houston and dealt Kyle Seager by then. Like, I don't know where you're going to be listening to this thing.
But eight hours ago, from this very moment,
I barely slept after that, man. So this is a challenge. I'm going to do my best to, like, rein in the level of crazed
just a podcast
optimism.
Voice, Michael, right. You listened to many a podcast before we got
please.
Ready to go for.
You know what? That's a good point.
Please don't. Do
last
that.
Night there was a game. Hold on, let me do this. I got a better one. Hold on. That's the sound of T-Mobile Park. T-Mobile Park was built in 2001 in the remains of what used to be the Kingdom. The Kingdom had all kinds of problems, but we'll get to that in a later episode. When it was built, it was called Safeco Field, and it was sold out for 542 straight games by crazed Mariner fans who didn't know anything about baseball but loved Ichiro. They thought Alex Rodriguez was the devil, and they were ready to win forever.
Okay, I'm done.
You're done? You don't want to keep going?
No,
that's just the setup. Enter a man called Howard Lincoln. Howard Lincoln had been a businessman, very successful, who had found a way to infiltrate ownership with the Seattle Mariners.
You're missing the factual interjection from the co-host that goes, well, you know, also, I was thinking about when, you know, the other teams that would come into play, they complained about the batter's eye. So
the batter's eye.
That was right.
Well,
so, yeah.
That's right.
Howard Lincoln
big
was an
batter's eye
attorney
issues.
For Nintendo as well.
Howard Lincoln found a way to infiltrate Nintendo, which made him a major figure in how the Mariners would behave for the next 20 years. All right, anyway, enough podcast voice, dude. I'm too excited. What a phenomenal. I just wanted to put some context on the big Mariners win, and then we kind of figure out where they're at in general, because there's so many interesting kind of angles that come off that game. But I was thinking to myself that there are, Brock, every year, with almost every team in baseball, a crazy comeback game, right?
Yep.
Almost every year. And so, like, every year you get on Twitter and you're like, this is the greatest win of all time. And this, maybe. Like, I could come up with 3 or 4 of these off the top of my head for teams that ended up going nowhere. We could talk about the time Franklin Gutierrez homered off of Aaron Loop, and we wrote a song about it. Aaron Loop, by the way, turned out to be one of the best relievers in baseball a couple of years later, but that's a story for another
episode.
You're kind
of still talking in podcasts.
I know, you got me kind of hooked into that.
This is the story of Franklin Gutierrez.
Sorry.
We get into the Dave Sims pronunciation, like you get deep onto Goody. Seriously, though, you've had a bunch of these years where you've had these crazy games.
12-2.
That's right.
To the Padres. I'll never forget that. Sitting on my couch and ding and ding. And I was trying to do something else. And every time they scored, I had a little ding and ding and ding. And they just come all the way back from a 12-2 deficit.
That was a big Dejo game, right? Oof. Dejo had a really big role in the. So these games don't always matter. Teams have big comebacks. It happens sometimes in baseball. But. They don't always do it on July 26th against the Astros, coming off of those huge wins against the A's, and with the trade deadline just a couple days away, and you're hoping that Jerry DePoto is going to make the huge moves that you want to put your team over the top. So while I don't know whether we don't know yet whether or not this comeback win will signify the beginning of something, whether it'll truly be meaningful, it certainly has a lot more possibilities than some of those others.
Well, I think because of the timing, as you referenced there, 61 games to go, but more importantly, a pretty enormous day. There's no longer, as I understand it, the waiver claim. Praise God.
Yeah, the waiver trade deadline's
bye
done.
Bye-bye.
It's just
three
the real...
years in the past, and see you later.
It's just the real trade deadline still.
So you have this week, and deadlines spur action and deals, and this is a market that has a bunch of teams that are competitive, a bunch of teams with different needs, but certainly lots of needs in the starting rotation, as the Seattle Mariners do. But as we've said, really, for the last 3 weeks on the regular, man, what has this team shown? Jerry DePoto, John Stanton, management, leadership, its own manager. What have they shown them in this month of July? Really, over the course of all 4 months of this season through 100 games, what have they shown them? And they like each other. They believe in one another.
Were you worried for Dylan Moore's health after his Grand Slam? I was worried that somebody on his team was going to hit him so hard they were going to knock him over. Like, he came back after the... First of all, there's pimping a Grand Slam, and then there's, like, knowing that you've hit it the second
no
you got
doubter.
It. Doubter. It's funny. When he hit it, I thought he had pulled it foul. Wow. That was my immediate reaction. Oh, he got out in front of that one, and he pulled it foul. But his, he knew.
We got the Mike Blowers. Wow.
He...
Bases loaded, two outs.
It's the first time I've really heard that. Heather and I were too busy celebrating when he actually hit it. The moment he tossed that bat, put the hands in the air,
pointed at the dugout.
Like, oh, man, that's a serious adrenaline moment.
Whoa.
Yep. That was. I thought he was going to get beaten up.
He rounded the bases in about 18 seconds.
Yes.
Maybe less.
I bet
seconds.
You. It would be interesting to go back and see which took longer, his trip around the bases or Javier Baez's trip to first base the other day. Did you see that? Did you see Baez hit the game-winning home run? And like, it took him, I think it was 16 seconds to get to first base. That was a pass and run.
That's four times longer than it's supposed to take.
It took him. He like brought out his bat and like did like a whole like paddling a boat thing. Like, it was for a team like the
good
Cubs that's about to sell. Like, okay, good for you, buddy. So
it's, I mean, listen, it's worth playing as much as you could play from that game. Like, that was insane, and just the nostalgia of Riz doing his thing.
Oh. You got Riz doing it too?
It was something, man.
Now the left-handers, 1-1 pitch to Dylan. Swing and a well-hit ball deep to left field. Grandma, get out the rye bread and mustard. Grand salami time. Upper deck left field down the line. Dylan Moore with a grand salami. And the Mariners lead the Astros 11-8 in one of the greatest comebacks I've seen in a long, long time.
Yeah. So they like each other.
That kind of gets those emotional hooks right in you, doesn't it?
Oh. Whoa.
Wow.
It's amazing. And then you can just get the low of what it must have sounded like on the other side.
Oh, do
like,
you have that?
Oh, man. Yeah.
Really here. 1-2 pitch is crushed and deep, and that's a slam. Upper deck. Grand slam. Dylan Moore.
That was funny. I like that one. That was pretty good.
A Hawk and Harrelson smashed tribute there.
Jeez. He was toasted. Deck. Oh, so, Brock, just to come back.
Howdy is just so itching to put a song together.
I know.
Howdy is just, Salk is out of his mind. He doesn't sleep last night. He and Heather are screaming. Howdy's gathering every piece of sound he can. He's itching to put something together. And I think you got a community. As I've listened to that stadium, I saw Kevin Martinez there with the Mariners tweet it after the Oakland win, I believe, on Sunday, saying, hey, I've been in the stadium a lot. And just the juice, just the energy in this place, the emotion of this place, right? After being absent a season ago, after having a lot of downs, right? And some tough times in this place, man, the emotion in that building's unique. And I think also this team's feeding off that.
Yeah. So I just wanted you to come back to where you started, which is you said that you've learned that the team really likes each other. Are there a few others in there that you think you've really picked up on from them?
Well, you tweeted grit, right? Which is the ultimate buzzword. You love that. And from a TED talk years ago, Pete Carroll loved that word, and evaluators have always loved that. And everybody watching sports, right? And Olympics are going on too, and different stories of people overcoming difficult spots. And we love to just throw that word around. That's a label that we love on our teams, you know, the love with our players. So I don't know. I mean, I said it 2 months ago with JP Crawford. I exaggerated it of how much he means to this group. It's just the straw that stirs everything. But that dude loves to play ball, and he's at the top of the lineup, and he sets the table for everybody else. And you just see, instead of hangdog looks, even when there's a lot of zeros, right? I mean, this isn't a perfect team by any stretch. There's still big gaps in the bottom of their lineup and a bunch of dudes that are struggling there. But you don't see that hangdog, just Eli Manning face. You see a bunch of dudes that pick each other up and enjoy playing. And yeah. I know that's easy to say when you're 9 games above 500.
No, I think you're right about it. But
for 2.5
months. I think there are a lot of people who will say, okay, so what? So they like each other. Well, I'll tell you, so what? I think what that leads to is some of the unselfish play you've seen from them over the course of the year.
Yep.
And I know that's hard to think about in baseball because it's such a one-on-one individual sport wrapped up in this team's concept. But, you know, when you see – we talked about the game at the time, and I thought the big comeback win mimicked it. When you say Kikuchi got bombed for the second straight day and they had lost 2 to the Yankees, but instead of coming out after 2, he fought and found a way to get through 5 – Yep. They almost completed the comeback against the Yankees that day. They weren't able to get the final hit to get over the top. They weren't able to get the grand slam that Dylan Moore hit. Okay, fine. But they made that a one-run game. The next day, they beat the Yankees, and they win a couple straight and are right back in the hunt instead of allowing those two losses to let them completely go out to forget about it. Not allowed to say what I was about to say. Sorry about that.
Well, you could on podcast.
Not really. No, yeah. We're
good. Howdy can edit. They just post-prod.
You have no idea post-prod. How many things I've deleted out of these podcasts. I don't think that's going
to
come off.
I should start listening to them, I guess. So, don't you think this is sort of the same thing where you get this poor kid, McCacken, who's just not ready for prime time at all, and that's a big conversation about why that guy's even out there. You could have had Taiwan Walker. They should have made a deal a month ago for a starting pitcher, and their needs at the position are gigantic. But here you are watching Darren McCacken get beat around like a pinata, and what does he do? He finds a way to make it through 4. He wasn't good. He gave up 6 in the first, but rather than he left him out there to suffer. He had to pay his price to the good of the team. And because he made it through 4 and then Middleton and then a couple of really good innings from Swanson, and the next thing you know, you just keep clawing and grasping and all of it. And the next thing you know, you're back in the game. I really didn't sleep last night. So there you go.
What happened in San Diego?
Deho and like.
No, not that. Not
yeah,
that
it's like, wait, this
because
year
it was in
or
San Diego. We were not having any of this conversation. San Diego, it was like, oh.
Yeah, they seemed to hit a nadir.
It was not competitive. Right? It was blowout city. It was none of this conversation. People picking each other up. It was just like, wow, they folded. And this crew is just, are they going to just fold at the table? Is this it? And I don't know. I'll be curious. And it's too early. We're 100 games in. There's still 60 to go. Can you tell me a series or a grouping of games since that moment where they've not been competitive? Where they've not shown growth. They've not won every
series. Not more
series.
Than
they've
one game in
game.
A row. No, I mean, they've had, you know, all of the starts from Robert Duggar, right, have generally
Injustice,
been.
Sheffield.
Yeah, I mean, there have been some non-competitive starts. But not where they've put them together and played non-competitively. Not at all. No, they seem to battle and scratch and all of that. And then you throw in what I mean, I don't want to keep coming back to this, but Scott Servais is managing the living heck out of the roster he has.
Yep.
He is getting every single drop available out of this roster. And over the last week against both the A's and Astros, his managerial moves, I know we've mostly given Scott credit for his culture building and all that stuff. His in-game management has been flawless. It's like every single bullpen move he's made has worked out perfectly. Whether it's going with Seawald for an extra inning on Friday so that you still have Steckenrider available to close on Sunday, or whether it's this huge comeback game where, I mean, he decided to use every weapon at his disposal in that game, right?
Yes. Three catchers in the lineup.
He used all three catchers. He got down to pinch hit in the final inning. He decided to use Graveman in the eighth, not down a run, not knowing whether or not that was going to be a complete waste. If you don't end up coming back, you waste Graveman there, and then you have save opportunities the next two nights or big close games and you can't use them, you're going to be pointing at him and saying, you blew this. But he had enough faith in his team that they were going to get to the Astros bullpen, which isn't very good. It's the weakness of this great team that he went and used Graveman and fired all of those bullets. I thought it was just a clinic in managing. And then you add to that sticking up for JP Crawford, right? nearly getting into a fight with the entire Astros team, yes. which was awesome.
So good.
And what then I don't know.
Dusty Baker wanted no part.
I don't know whether you noticed it, but how about him staying after that game to applaud the fans?
Yep.
He was just standing
like
up.
A soccer player.
Yes.
Applauding the fans.
It was like Hideki Matsui's caddy. bowing
to
Matt.
To T-Mobile.
Yes. Park. I mean, it just, it seems like it's one thing after another. And this poor guy's still unsigned. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, you've been clamoring for that for some time.
What else does he have to do?
What happened last time they extended him midseason?
That's true. Yes. They did go in the tank. But what else does this poor guy have to do?
Well, most importantly, he's got these guys just enjoying playing for one another. I think he even he's commented on that. You know, and that's very hard to quantify. And I know baseball guy really hates any of that stuff and any of those bonding moments and any of that emotional stuff in a clubhouse and everything else. But you just, you know, you get that sense and that feel as it doesn't really matter who it is that comes up. It's a pretty welcoming environment. It's been that way. I think that's probably been his greatest strength through all of the turmoil, the roster churn, the rebuild. Is if you were to say to me, once again, I'll pull out my yellow legal pad and say, okay, what has been, through your observation, Scott's greatest strength as a manager of men, manager of professional baseball players? I would say right at the top of that list is he has cultivated a clubhouse that sure appears welcoming and the guys want to be a part of. That I get that sense from the level that I look at it and what I read into it and as I watch body language and everything else, pretty darn welcoming environment. We have seen the fruit of that with uber talent with the Seattle Seahawks, because I think Pete Carroll through chaos does the exact same thing, right? Welcoming players in, letting them be who they are, empowering them. And I think that is Scott's greatest strength. I will also say, from a pure numbers and baseball standpoint, the one group that we've not talked about this year and even last year with some of their success, their analytics team, Mike, the people doing their analysis for their bullpen in particular, is off the charts. So I don't know how many new faces have come in there over the last few years, right? How much of that conversation's been had. I do reckon back to some of those trade deadline moves, previous relievers at times, and Jerry and the mess that those were. Based on the success of so many of these pieces in the bullpen that they brought in the last couple of years, man, I have more confidence than ever. If they go out and get an arm this week, albeit as a starter or in the bullpen, I can't wait to see that guy folded into this team.
So let's hit on a couple of the major question marks now moving forward. And I don't know, maybe some of these will be settled by the time you listen to this podcast, but, you know, we're a prisoner of the moment. So, you know, one, what are you going to do with the trade deadline?
What's the over under? 1.5? 2?
I mean, I've been sort of taking the under on 2.5. I really think it's going to be hard for them to pull off too many deals. But let's throw out a few of the names that we've heard here in the last couple of days. The two biggest names we've heard are Whit Merrifield, second baseman and utility guy. He can play a little of everywhere, but primarily a right-handed second baseman for the Royals, who still has a couple of years left on a reasonable contract. And this just came out from John Morosi, Trey Turner, who is like a much better version of that.
If he was on a better team, he would be one of the front runners for the MVP.
He's a really, really good player.
Right? 330 last year, too.
Now, with him, you have him signed through this year. You've got arbitration next year, and then he'd be gone. So he's sort of in Haniger's camp in terms of the time left on his deal. So if you're trading for him, A, you've got to give up a lot. You're probably giving up Noelvi Marte and stuff.
You may have to give up one of your best pitching prospects.
Yeah, I mean, it might have to be Marte and Hancock, right? I mean, that could be the kind of package it would take to get someone like him.
He's a shortstop.
He can play second base. He could play center field. He could really play just about anywhere. So are you willing to start giving up major parts of your future for a 28-year-old Trey Turner who you would then need to sign for big money?
I'm not. And honestly, as you're having this conversation, and earlier this week, I was chatting with Danny and Paul about this. And once again, it's been a long time, like almost 23 years since this happened. But the Seahawks reintroduced Joey Galloway. This Mariners team reminds me of the 99 Seahawks. And I know, Salk, you were like 23 and in college and everything else. But the 99 Seahawks were 8-2 and a bunch of role players and a bunch of castoffs and Sean Dawkins and Derek Mays that ran a 5-flat 40 and couldn't bench 225 one time. And John Kitna, who, you know, Mike Holmgren didn't love his skill set and everything else, but all John did was win that year. And we're 8-2, and Joey Galloway's holding out. And all of a sudden, we get Joey Galloway back, man, one of the most dynamic players in the game, right? Unbelievably fast. Big holdout, big contract dispute. Here he comes for the final 6 weeks. 1-5. And in particular, a loss to Tampa Bay, Sean King, Tony Dungy, cover two. Oh, let's just take shots. Let's take shots. Let's get Joey the ball. We got to get Joey the ball. And get our doors beat in. And 1-5 down the stretch. And I know baseball is totally different. It's independent contractors. It's all talent. I've learned all of those things. But I'm not going to spend 30 minutes talking about the intrinsic values of this team and the bonding and the grit of this team and then think, yeah, just throw somebody in who's a super dynamic shortstop. And, yeah, J.P. Crawford.
But he doesn't know. That's not what you do.
I know.
You put him at second base.
We'll play him at third, everything else.
Well, no, you just play him at second.
This is J.P.
Or you play
Crawford's
him in center
team.
Field when you send down Jared Kelnick, and that's the next conversation we're going to have. He's not going to replace J.P. Crawford.
Trey Turner wants to play second.
He'd play wherever you want. I mean, that's what's great about him. He's not like this shortstop guy who, it's not like when A-Rod was so gracious as to move to third base to make way for the great Derek Jeter, most selfish player in history for what he did there, but whatever. It's not like that. He honestly plays center. He plays second. He plays short. He's like Ben Zobrist like that, except he's just significantly better.
He's super twitchy, man. He was at the All-Star game. He must have weighed 180 pounds athlete, right? Just a dynamic,
18 homers, yes. 21 stolen bases, three caught, an 887 OPS. Last year had a 982 OPS in 335.
I'm not giving up Marte or Emerson
I think I am. For something like that. Now, you got to sign him afterwards. That's got to be, you sort of have to know that you're going to be able to sign him. But yeah, I'm probably willing to give up something significant because that's a future building block. My window is really 22, 23, 24. And he helps me for sure in 22. And if I can sign him through all of those years, he's only 28. I like that better than Merrifield. Now, you don't have to give up as much for Merrifield.
Correct.
So I could be talked into Merrifield.
So we're going Saks.
Because
Fifth Avenue, Costco, Value Village. Is that what I saw?
Not really. I mean, to a point. I mean, the nice thing about Merrifield is, what do you have to give up? Well, you know, is that a package where you're giving up some names like Taylor Trammell, Shed Long, and then maybe, I don't know,
Wanthan type of prospect.
Yeah, Wanthan,
Williams.
Someone in that range, sort of your next tier of pitching prospect.
8 to 15
prospect. Kudos to Wanthan. He's been on this podcast the last 3 weeks. Way to go, Wan.
I think I'd make that deal, too. Like, I'd probably do something like that, and that's a good player who helps you and plays second base, and, you know, maybe he hits the grand slam last night.
He's one of the fastest guys in baseball. He's an amazing. He's basically a better, more consistent version of Dylan Moore.
Yeah.
Which
and much
would be
better.
Awesome.
Much better, though.
Not a lot of power, but a lot more consistent and dependable version of that guy.
Okay. So I'd probably make either one of those deals. If I can't make either one of them, you know, you also have Jonathan Scope out there who you could give up very little for, and he can just come in and play second base for the rest of this year. So their options are great at second base. Here's the problem. What they really need is a starting pitcher. All of these conversations and all of these rumors are all about second base and bats, and that's great. But you can't keep rolling out Darren McCacken. Heck, you could barely keep rolling out Yusei Kikuchi.
Please, stop. Enough with the Kikuchi bashing.
I'm sorry.
At least
no, it'll
right
all be
now.
Fine when they get Justin Dunn back, Howdy. My bad.
Yeah,
I forgot
by the way,
about how
Justin
much
Dunn's
you
numbers
love...
are identical to Logan Gilbert's through his start of his career so far this season.
Yeah. He's your fifth starter.
Really good.
I've watched both guys pitch. Thanks. I don't need your numbers. I've watched both guys pitch, and I've seen the difference.
Ascending.
Thanks.
That's a better option.
Mm-hmm.
Where is Justin Dunn? Howdy, is he close? Have you been?
Didn't you see him last night dancing with Shed Long, waiting for Dylan Moore in the dugout? Yeah. They were dancing a jig.
I thought they were going to punch him. They were so excited.
No, he was throwing off a mound. I think this week he's starting to come back.
I thought he was doing a touch and feel session, or maybe that's Sheffield.
What does that mean? Like he's putting his hands in a mystery box? Mean.
It's going to be like...
This is a spaghetti.
It's going to be like snacks.
Rice Krispie treat.
Yes. It's what Snacks Harrison did at Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Oh, that's mashed potatoes.
Oh, that's mashed potatoes. Yeah, that's mashed potatoes. My kids still ask about snacks all the
feeling
time.
Feeling around in a diorama.
Anyway, they need pitching, man. I don't care what you think about Justin. Even if Justin Dunn comes back and is good, they still need pitching.
They got Justice Sheffield.
They still need pitching.
Oh, they got you need a seventh starter?
Yes.
They got McCacken.
Well.
McCacken.
Well. They got Duggar.
No.
The tough part about pitching is Are you confident that if you're going to spend real prospect resources for a really good starting pitcher, that guy's even going to pitch the rest of the season?
It's true. I mean, like everybody out there. But you have the same problem with your own starters. Logan Gilbert's never gone this far into a season. None of these guys threw many innings last year. And now you're just starting to reach that point of like, are you going to start to see some breakdowns?
Yep.
You've already had your guys lost for the year. You've already lost Paxton. You've already lost the lefty. What's his name? Who Howdy doesn't like, but he's better
James
than
Paxton.
Justin Dunn. No, the other the other lefty. What's the kid's name with the long name?
Oh, yeah, Mishevitz?
No, the other lefty. The one who's hurt. Mishevitz pitched like yesterday.
Margavichus?
Margavichus, thank you. They've already...
LJ Newsom? What's going on here?
No, the other lefty.
They've lost a bunch of those guys. So, all right.
They're going to add starters. I'm
going to have to.
They're going to add them.
Next question, Brock. What's going on with the kid? What's going on with Jared Kelnick?
It's a hard watch right now. It is a hard one. I shot you guys a text last night, and I saw him in person. I watched him play in person as well. And man, I hope they're not breaking him. And they know this better than any of us do. And Andy McKay and that team. And from a development standpoint, I think you've got to feel more confidence in them than you have any of the groups that preceded them with some of their young players and with some of the development game and some of the patience that they have shown. And the little bright spot here with Cal Raleigh, the bright spot with Logan Gilbert. But there's a big part of me, man, that really wonders, are you breaking this kid's brashness? Mm. Right, I mean, are you just, he is, it's been a slice of humble pie after another slice, and it's been pies. It's been multiple humble pies.
Yeah.
Where
now he's found some ways to contribute, right?
He has.
Got to give the kid credit.
Huge walks.
Huge. Plays hard.
He's a battler, man. He's a battler. It's so funny. A couple of really good at-bats to take those walks, and they've both mattered, and he's gotten the recognition from his teammates, which has been great, and I'm sure that helps
with
some what you're
Casper
talking about.
Casper the Friendly Ghost.
Seriously. Or Tony Montana, depending on how you look at it. Secondly, there was no doubt in my mind after he got the single against the A's the other day, he was going to try to steal second. And he ended up getting thrown out. I was like, I think they knew too. Like, he's desperate to try to show his worth and to help and to do what his teammate Cal Raleigh is doing, right? To really show that he's part of this thing. I guess when I watch him, what I see is someone who is having defensive at bats instead of aggressive ones.
Yep.
He looks like he's hanging on for dear life and trying to get a hit as opposed to commanding the zone, feeling confident, and forcing the pitcher into a defensive position. Now, that doesn't tell me that he's a bad player. It tells me that he might not have seen enough baseball in the minors to be fully ready for this. That one when thing, you have that mental knowledge, you can allow the physical to kick in. His physical, he's totally ready. It's, has he seen enough? Does he have enough of the mental understanding? I mean, man, listen to Mike Blowers over the last week. Dude calls literally everything that's about to happen. It's unreal. Blauer's prognostication is off the charts, and I know he gets credit for like the crazy 2-1 years ago, which was fluky and crazy, but seriously, listen to him. He legitimately called the second straight wild pitch the other day. Oh yeah, it'd be nice if they just did a second straight. Bam, there you go. Mm-hmm. The other, we're watching the guy, oh, he's going to come back with a splitter now and miss with, and sure enough, next pitch was split. He missed with it, but like, it's constant. The dude has just watched so much baseball and played a lot of it himself that he knows what's going to happen. I've told you the story of sitting with Bill Hasselman and him calling 16 straight pitches of what the guy was going to throw. Jared Kelnick played like 4 innings in the minors. He's really talented, but he's 22, just turned 22. I just don't think he's seen enough baseball to have the mental understanding of what's happening to give him the confidence to let the physical take over right now.
Couple fun little things along those lines. Titus become a little pitcher, and I love it. He loves it.
Little.
Maybe not so little. And dude's my neighbor
bigger than
here.
Kelnick.
Yeah, my neighbor played up to AA with the Rangers. He was a catcher. And he's just a terrific guy. And he's got two younger boys that love Titus, and they came to a game, and he was sitting next to me. And it was so fascinating. So I know it's 11-year-old club baseball. It's not major leagues. But to that degree, he's sitting there going, oh, gosh, you got to throw this one up at his hands. Oh, see how late he was? Oh, look at the front shoulder. Oh, I mean, he's like What are you even looking at? Like he just knew, like, you know, what you should do and where every next pitch should be, and not that Titus has that kind of command at all. But it was fascinating just hearing him watch every swing, look at every, you know, the body language, look at the body movement, look at the hands, look at the shoulders, look at the feet, and knowing how he would attack that guy. Much like, you know, when you sat with Hasselman and you watch pros do it and they know how to attack. Is Jared Kelnick at that place? There's no possibility whatsoever. There's no chance that he's in. He's just trying to make contact. He's just trying to put the ball in play so he can use his speed. So then my next question, and this is what I would ask Scott Servais too. Do you remember sitting there on one of those matinees, and Scott, I forget who we were talking about, but he's like, yep, you get about a pitch and a bat, maybe one and a half. At the major league level, that's about all you get typically in a bat that, you know, that you can really do damage with, that favors you, the hitter, that you're like, yep, that's the one, or maybe that's the one and a half where you're facing a slappy, maybe you get two. You go to AAA, very different story, right? So is that a benefit to go down to AAA and face guys where you get three pitches and hacks at it and swings at it? And all of a sudden you come up and, oh, my confidence is more instilled, and then I'm reminded, oh, that's right. Well, with this guy, I don't even get one quality pitch. I'm in defense mode all the time and just try to put something in play. So managing that. And then lastly, and I texted you this last night, Mike, I want him around this team. I want him around J.P. Crawford. I want him around Dylan Moore. I want him around Lewis Torrens. I want him around Tom Murphy. I want him around these guys that haven't had it handed to them on a platter, that have taken the road less traveled, that have had to work incredibly hard to be there, because I think there's great benefit to be around this group of guys that I don't think you're getting much or any of that rubbing off on you at AAA in Tacoma. So you factor all of that in, but you also can't be hitting, you know, .097, right? I mean, you just...
No, and as I said, just the defensive nature of his at-bats are what worry me, is that it looks like it's like he's into foul it off mode as soon as he gets up there. Yep. Oh, he's down 0-2, and now he's fouling it off. There's never that moment where it's like he's in charge of this at-bat. And by the way, a couple of those started off 3-0, and he still looked defensive after that. He just doesn't have that command of the zone, which is fine.
Yep.
He's really young. I am not panicked in any way. I'm mildly worried. I mean, like one on the scale of 10. But, you know, at some point, you sure are going to want to see it from him, because he's kind of the big, like, he's the difference maker.
Gosh,
like, you watch the best
Raleigh
teams out there.
Isn't it? It's fun to see him.
Dude, that 444-foot home run he hit. He's got so much Jason Varitek in him, it is scary. Ooh. It really, really
was
just...
Was Varitek a switch hitter?
It sure was.
Yeah,
switch-hitting catcher, really good defensive player, leadership capabilities, built just big and strong, runs into a couple of home runs now and again. Yeah, he really, really reminds me of Jason Varitek, the one who got away in Seattle, I understand.
Heathcliff's local,
yeah,
I believe.
It worked out pretty well. Hey, you want to hear about something cool? I know we talk a lot about Ascend and what they're doing up at their incredible Bellevue location, all that, but the Ascend Hospitality Group is partnering with an old friend, Brock, former Seahawk, Cliff Averill, and the Cliff Averill Family Foundation. They are launching the Cliff Has Your Back programs. This is pretty cool. Unique collaboration. It's sponsored by Amazon, local Amazon Fresh store in Bellevue as well. And they're providing underprivileged children with a one-of-a-kind custom-designed backpack experience for the 2021 back-to-school season. Second year in a row, the Cliff and Ascend have partnered together. So they, you know, different missions that kind of come together for this. So for Cliff and the Cliff Averill Family Foundation, they are looking to increase the awareness of type 2 diabetes in youth and to encourage healthy living through nutrition and exercise. So again, youth focus. And for Ascend, their main philanthropic focus is on education and feeding its community. So this comes together because they met at a famous Dave's Barbecue in Tukwila, obviously, not the Ghost Kitchen.
Where it all goes down.
It's where deals are made, man. And they created this whole backpack's distinct design using a paint-filled balloon thing tethered to 10-foot-tall blank canvases. And that's how they went through it. They rifled footballs at balloon targets, popping and releasing the paint to fashion the design for the bags.
Brock, you would have been great at that.
I should have been there.
Yeah, Brock would have been trying to do the jugs thing that Brady was doing.
Oh, yeah. Fake.
That's real, right?
Fake.
No, that's real. Sure. That's fake. definitely real. Anyway, each backpack includes school supplies provided by Ascend and Amazon, as well as USDA-approved grocery shopping lists, nutritional guides, healthy lifestyle tutorials, food education activity sheets, plus $25 gift card to shop at any Amazon Fresh grocery store. So it's pretty cool. Now through August 13th, members of the community are able to nominate students for the backpack experience. Go to ascendhg.com/AHG cares. I know that's sort of a long one, but ascendhg.com. That's ascendhospitalitygroup.com/AHG cares. Sunday, August 22nd, 3 to 6, Averill and Ascend are going to host a pickup event for all the recipients at the Amazon Fresh in Bellevue. So pretty cool. Pretty cool stuff going on from Cliff Averill, who I think is going to join us here in the next couple of weeks to talk a little bit more about this, and from Ascend.
Awesome.
So that's a lot of Mariners to really start this show. I'm pretty impressive considering we are like on the eve of training camp. But just to kind of sum up, Brock, takeaways from the whole Mariners thing. One, extend Scott Servais. Are we both in agreement there?
Yep.
Two, you got to make a deal. And I'm a little bit more willing to be aggressive than you are, but only on guys where you're going to be continuing to build around them in the future. Brock's point, much more so that if you're going to add, it better fit into your team chemistry, and you better not mess up this whole team concept that you've developed. I think you're right about that.
Yep.
And then finally, Kelnick, not quite on the worry meter yet. Still on a one on your little tooth scale.
Long shanks?
No, I was going to say on your tooth scale. Oh. It's a 1-1-1. Mm. We're not even at a 2-2-1 or anything like that. But, you know, warrants watching as he just looks defensive, right?
Yep. I think that's very fair.
Then you'll see what happens when Jake Fraley comes back in the next couple days, whether or not Kelnick's still up or whether or not he's the move to get some. There's so many moves and moving pieces here in the next couple of days that we'll just have to wait and see. All right. Seahawks getting ready, Brock, on the eve of training camp. It is a tradition every year we give you our best storylines to watch for heading into camp. So here we go. You ready? I've got 5.5 storylines. Five plus a bonus. Okay.
Can you count down from your 25 most intriguing Seahawks?
No.
I was just thinking that. We would have had to start that in like December.
Most intriguing Seahawk this year, though, is Daryl Taylor, if we were doing that.
Okay.
That's a number one for me. Most intriguing is Daryl Taylor, isn't it? Most intriguing.
Yeah, probably.
A lot of mystery.
Yeah, Dwayne Eskridge, Jordan Brooks. Yeah,
it's the new Marquise tight end Blair. That everyone's talking up way too big.
Gerald Everett? That guy's not the most intriguing
people
Seahawk.
People are talking him up like he is going to change the tight end position in Seattle.
That's fine.
That he's is intriguing.
Not, he's still not more intriguing than Daryl Taylor, who could potentially come give you a huge lift in terms of... Anyway, I'm not getting into this debate with you, Howdy.
It's DeMarco Jones. Move on.
That's who Brock wants to watch. Brock can't wait to get to practice to watch DeMarco Jones. Yes. All right. You ready? Five storylines heading into training camp for the Seahawks. Number one, Shane Waldron. What does his offense look like? Will it lead to a happy quarterback and a happy head coach at the same time?
Yep. Would agree with that. And that's just your BBNN love coming through there. I am so curious to see and hear and listen and read. I mean, is the casual fan is out there, right? Is they're all back on the berm? Maybe not all of them, but as a bunch of them are back there on the berm, are they watching these Seahawks going, geesh, man, this looks like the Rams. I love all these bunch formations and I love their tempo. And there's Shane Waldron in Russell's ear, right? Just, you know, lots of tempo and lots of checks and all of this stuff and outside run and screens. And man, this looks like Rams 2.0 up in Seattle. And instead of Andrew Whitworth, it's Dwayne Brown who's securing the edge. And Chris Carson is slicing and dicing and slashing. And wow, looks like Todd Gurley. Right from the Super Bowl year, or is it? Geesh, man, these guys look like Shanahan. I know that Waldron was under McVay, but gosh, this jet sweep, these two tight ends, this heavy play action, this Gerald Everett guy seems to be a centerpiece. You know, kind of is Shanahan has used George Kittle and his guys down there. And man, this looks like and they even got a fullback every once in a while. It's not Juszczyk, but. But, man, they're even mixing personnel left and right. So I'm kind of just deeply curious and anxious to see and hear what this looks like from this day forward, because it is and should be vastly different.
Well, and here's the other part of it. If you're this is more of the like the soap opera side of it. Shane Waldron is stuck between arguably the two most powerful figures in Seattle sports. right? He's got Pete Carroll on one side who wants balance, and he's got Russ in his other ear saying he wants to cook, to throw, to have more easy completions, etc. He's stuck right in the middle of these two guys like Steelers wheel, man. Yep. So how he handles that, how he handles balancing those two incredible personalities who were at odds at some point and now seem to have found a way to put it behind them and get back together here, that's a really big challenge, all the while trying to institute your new offense. And, you know, Brock, I can't wait for you to tell me whether it looks more like Shanahan or more like McVay. I'm just hoping, quite frankly, they're able to get a play call in with more than, you know, 2 seconds left on the clock so they don't have to call timeout.
Well, most importantly, I hope we see built-in answers. Whether it's McVay, whether it's Shanahan, whether it's some of these other systems.
What do you mean built-in answers?
That the ball, the Russ is getting the ball out. As you watch practice and he's watching these preseason games, he's not holding the ball, right? That was the crux of the huge argument in the second half of last season from the Giants game and others was, yeah, we shouldn't have answers, right? We had a game plan going in, but man, we just didn't adjust. We didn't adapt. We didn't get the ball out of Russ's hands. Russ wants less sacks. What Russ wants to be protected, right? Russ doesn't want to get hit. Made that pretty clear to Dan Patrick. So in order to do those things, you have to have some place to go with the football. You have to have built-in places to go and built-in answers. And I'll add one more thing, by the way, to the most intriguing. And this is a guy that's been there a couple years. And we saw as last year went on, we saw helmets tossed. We saw raw emotion and passion on a sideline. We saw a guy that's really grown with his voice offensively more than anybody else. And that's DK Metcalf. And DK is in a contract year, right? As the salary cap explodes in his mind, I'm sure he thinks I'm the greatest in the game. Julio has slowed down. Nuke Hopkins isn't what he used to be. I'm a number one of number ones, and I want the ball, and I want to showcase that. And we watched that persona grow in confidence really over the second half of last year too, even in the playoffs. So I will be very curious to keep an eye and an ear to DK Metcalf as well.
Yes. That is a lot for this new guy to balance. I'm sure he had to deal with a lot of the same things at BBNN. So I know he's got a lot of that history built in and how to handle really...
Didn't have to deal with it with the Rams.
Difficult, right? Personalities. No.
You know, those guys, right? They're guys all block and you don't have number ones and number ones. And
well, it's just great McVay show. Their quarterback stunk. I mean, like, you know, there wasn't that much. They didn't really have any of that.
But Robert Woods and Cooper Kupp and those guys getting bunched. And they block linebackers and safeties, and they're totally selfless, and will do whatever is asked. And, you know, I think DK is certainly super unselfish, and Tyler is as well. But DK in particular wants his touches. Contract year, wants to be paid as the best receiver in the game, wants to show that he can be that. So, yeah, I think you add his voice right in between Pete and Russell as well.
All right, number two storylines we're watching heading into training camp. And speaking of contracts, this is going to obviously be the biggest. This will be the first thing we're talking about. That's Jamal Adams. His contract, his leadership, and, you know, I think his performance on the field, what he ends up bringing to the table. Let's be honest, Brock. They gave up more to get this guy than anyone in their tenure, right? That's how highly they thought of Jamal Adams and how much they needed him. They had to know the contract fight was coming, yeah. Right? And if they don't sign him, someone should get fired. Like, I think it's very, like, if you've done all of that, traded all that for him, and then you don't sign him and he walks away or whatever, that's like a fireable offense. So they're going to sign him. We all know this is the case.
And there is a little bit of positive news right now. Tweet from Josina Anderson earlier today. One source's opinion this morning on the Jamal Adams hashtag Seahawks contract situation. Quote, we are hopeful that the contract will get done soon. He's in town. A lot was given up to get him. I feel there's love on both sides.
Yeah.
We'll see. Physicals this morning, followed by team meetings.
As it should be, right? But if they want his leadership to factor in, which, you know, allegedly was one of the reasons they traded for him, they got to get this done like ASAP, right?
Yes. And if you do, will we see him? You're absolutely right. The Hawks paid a king's ransom for him. And it wasn't just for the football player. It's for the persona. It's for the edge. Do you remember those training camps early on? We go out there. I mean, Richard is clawing at Doug's face, right? Michael Bennett and Justin Britt are over the Gatorade, Like, that was, I mean, it was violent. It was loud, right? It was Cam Chancellor just patrolling and prowling the bat and run towards you at the sideline. You'd be like, oh, be like Nelson Cruz in Kyle's batting cage. Like, oh, man, these guys are ferocious. And then they moved on. And do you remember how quiet it was with Tedrick Thompson and crew? Remember how quiet it got in the absence of Richard and Earl and those guys, right? That's not Bobby. Bobby isn't loud. He's not all of those things. It got quiet out there in the practice, uncomfortably so. And I think I said that to you more than a time or two, Salk. Like, man, you know, Trey Flowers, Tedrick Thompson. I mean, where's the juice? Where's the energy? You know, Michael Bennett's gone. Where's the D line that's just like, yeah, killing these guys?
And I like what you wrote to me, Brock, last night. You said that you hear great defenses before you see them. I think it's a really good adage and something I'm going to try to remember. I think that's a great way of putting it. That's why you got Jamal Adams.
That is.
So that you would not just feel him, which
correct,
you should.
Which is important.
But hear him.
Yep.
He brings some of that exact mentality, swag, energy that you were talking about. So get him happy. Get him in camp. Or you're wasting part of the reason you were willing to give up so much for him. Because he is flawed. He's not a perfect football player.
And will we see him? You asked that. Right, I think Tuesday is a pretty significant day. You know I love injuries. I'm the son of a coach, after all. There have been some big moments of Percy Harvin's hip and everything else. And, you know, Tuesday is physicals. This guy has significant shoulder surgery, finger surgery, right? Is he going to be even able to participate in camp, right? Are we going to even see him on the field if that contract gets done, right? How much of that presence are we going to feel? How much of that noise are we actually going to hear? Or is this going to be, shoot, man, we're going to just have to wait till week one and they're going to have to manage him all the way through training camp with some of these others. So yeah, that 33 is, man, yeah, I know it's not storyline number one, but it should be 1A because it is significant.
Well, absolutely, right? I mean, you know, I think you have to be monitoring him. When is the contract done? Can he play? Can he be healthy? And then once he does, how does he handle the fact that the other teams may game plan for him this year?
Yep.
I mean, he had, what, 9.5 sacks last year? They're gonna pay attention to that. It's not like teams aren't going to notice that that occurred. And so can he cover? Can he force turnovers? Can he do some of the things that this team is going to need
from
him?
Can he catch with a healthy shoulder and fingers?
That would be helpful. It certainly would if he could catch. So, yeah, throw all that together, Brock, and I think you get a really interesting conversation there that we'll certainly be watching regarding Jamal Adams. All right, storyline number three. I don't know what my order is of these next, so these kind of go in any order. But okay, are any of these young draft picks going to become something beyond their expectation or even reach it? We're going on a few years here, man, where you really need, you know, we've had DK, obviously,
yeah,
but other than DK Metcalf, Schneider's hit rate with early picks has been pretty rough for a while. And so I got a group of guys that I think these are all first through third rounds that you're
which
looking
should
at.
Should be starters, if not Pro Bowlers, if not difference makers.
Jordan Brooks, Darrell Taylor, LJ Collier, Marquise Blair, Rasheem Green, all first through third rounders.
Mine.
Mm-hmm.
That's a name noticeably absent there. Rashad Penny?
I was just looking on the defense.
Oh, it's like, wait a minute.
That was just the defense. On the other side of the ball, you're looking at Penny, Eskridge, etc. So I was just looking at defense.
Woo.
I'm not leaving Penny out. Brock, yep. That's what, 2, 4, 6, 7 I mean, Eskridge, will wait and see. It's not like he's underperformed yet. But that's six guys that you're pointing at and saying you are first through third round. I left Will Disley off this list because I think he was a
fourth
rounder. But he's another one where kind of big expectations, and we've seen some of the promise, and just unfortunately last year never quite delivered up to what we were kind of hoping from. So I would put him on this list, but he's not a first through third rounder.
Yep.
I mean, really, you're looking at DK Metcalf's been an incredible success story. And you're pointing at Damian Lewis, who was a pretty good success as a third rounder last year on the offensive line. Other than that, man, where are your success stories from the first three rounds?
I mean, Jordan Brooks got his feet wet last year, right? He was good enough that you kind of felt you could move KJ to strong side linebacker. And I think there is heightened expectations there off the charts. Got to come in and you know what? You watched elite linebackers that can run sideline to sideline, change teams.
Brock, I'm not disagreeing with that. There's a lot of hope for Jordan Brooks. I still like him. I think LJ Collier may still have a decent season. Heck, I'm still like willing to be positive about Rashad Penny. But who's going to break out and not just occasionally flash?
Yeah,
these guys need to do more than occasionally flash.
Yeah,
they need to break out and be good
list,
players.
Yeah, if you're going to give me somebody on that list, I'm going to go with Jordan Brooks.
Why?
Because the D-line is as good as it's been depth-wise in a long time. He still has Bobby next to him. that is going to carry a brunt of the leadership and you know, the calls and everything else, and make sure he's in the right spot, cleats in the ground, face mask forward pre-snap, and then he's going to uncoil. And I think last year was a year about a little bit of injury, as a lot of undersized younger guys do. Man, he looked like a monster in the OTAs. I think he can't wait to put pads on. I think he knows the impact he can have. That door is open. KJ isn't there, right? That door is his, and that opportunity is his to seize. So I would put him way on that list, way high on that list. And I'm really curious about Marquise Blair too. He, an ACL just totally derailed and dismantled his season a year ago. And by all accounts, physically, he's in a unique place. And is he a safety? Is he a nickel? Is he a big dime? Is he an inside linebacker in nickel? Like, you know, if you're going to move Jamal around, Mike, and you don't want teams to be able to game plan and just always account for him, you have to have other unique pieces around him. And I think Blair is a pretty unique talent to do that. I was so high on, if you remember, coming out, like, this guy will knock your block off. He's not as big as Cam, but his explosion and his hit impact and his short area quickness is very unique.
Yeah, it's not John Schneider's fault or anybody else's fault that the guy's gotten hurt. I mean, like, that was a fluke accident. The guy gets hurt. Okay.
Yep.
But at some point, you need more of these guys to deliver. And this isn't about John's job or anything like that. But I am worried at times about where their draft picks have gone over the last few years.
Well, these are the guys you need if you're going to be a 12-win team.
They've got to get good, and not just flash. They have to be regularly making plays that help your team win. So that's storyline number three. Number four, has either line significantly improved? Essentially, can you block four with five, and can your four beat five? So on both sides of the line of scrimmage, can you control that thing? They lost the Rams game up front. I will say that till the day I die. Their offensive line couldn't protect, and their defensive line didn't get enough pressure to force LA into making mistakes and turnovers. So if they want to get back to being a dominant team, that quest starts and ends up front, doesn't it? They added Gabe Jackson. They added Kerry Hyder. Those were probably and Gerald Everett. I mean, those are big additions up front. Was that enough? Was that enough to change the way their lines function?
I remember doing these conversations the last few years and looking at it and trying to gauge, okay, plus minus, right? Like how much better did you add? Did you detract? Are you better at this spot? Are you worsened? You know, on paper, how does this thing look? And having grave concerns, as everybody did going into last year on that D line, and they were horrific. I mean, four couldn't beat five. Five couldn't beat five. Six couldn't beat five on your defensive line. That's why you were the worst in the history of the NFL through eight games. Statistically speaking, it was a joke. The game that I got to call against Buffalo, it was straight 7-on-7. Your four were Velcro. And your fifth, who tried to rush, and just got torched because of it. Well, make a few moves, add Jamal into the pass rush, trade for Carlos Dunlap, and things change the second half of the year.
And now you add Kerry Hyder to that.
Now you add Kerry Hyder and Al Woods and other, you know, and when Cliff Averill, we mentioned with the send in the backpack, says, yeah, this is the deepest crew on paper since 13. I don't know if I'm quite there. I like that crew better than this one.
Let's see what Alton Robinson brings to the table.
Yes,
Alton Robinson certainly flashed in some limited times last year. Can he do more than
second
that? Daryl Taylor is
rookie DN.
We just said Daryl Taylor's maybe the most intriguing guy to watch on this team. If he can be Bruce Irvin and what Bruce did, maybe even better at getting to the quarterback. Well, those are really significant additions that should change it. But I will keep point. I know the offensive line gets most of the ire from Seahawks fans because you got to protect Russ, and that hasn't gone away. But their defense, like, great teams win with great defensive lines. It was true with the Seahawks. Heck, it was true with the Bucks this past year and why they won the Super Bowl.
True with the Broncos, true with everybody. And as far as the O-line goes, let me just say, this system, whether it looks like the Rams, whether it looks like the 49ers, whether it looks like old Shanahan, this system, its job, number one, is to make your job easier up front. I shared that story. Sean McDermott, the head coach of Buffalo, saying, man, McVay's system, golly, it's an O-line's dream. It's so much easier. It just washes things down. It's wide zone, and here comes jet sweep, and here's the screen, as it just makes defensive lines hesitant. They should never be able to just pin their ears back and go, because here comes wide zone. Oh, is it the play action off of it? And Russell's unbelievable in play action. Is it the screen game off of it? Is it a movement off of it? Is it a jet sweep off of it? So this is a system that is designed at its very, very essence and core to make your job easier up front. So whether you think the personnel of adding Gabe Jackson and obviously bringing back some continuity with Damian Lewis and Ethan Posick and Dwayne and all of that, the very system should make the job easier on the boys up front.
All right, number five, fifth storyline watching heading into camp. How will Russell be received by his coaches, teammates, and fans? No one's going to be more forgiving than fans. They're the most fickle group, right? And I don't say that insultingly. It's how fans are, right? You're fickle. When the person does what you want them to do on the field, you're happy. When they don't, you're not. Russell maybe used up a little bit of the benefit of the doubt this offseason with the way he handled things, but fans are going to essentially react to how Russell plays in the field, and I expect Correct. That to be incredible. So his relationship with the fans, my guess, will be just fine. What about his... let's go to his coach is easy too, right?
Yep.
No one on the planet's more forgiving than Pete. He'll be fine. What about his teammates? What about Dwayne Brown? What about the offensive lineman that I certainly perceive that he threw under the bus publicly at the beginning of this offseason? Can he get on the same page with that group, and can he truly lead this team?
Yeah, I don't think that will be an issue either. And Dwayne would be the one that's got all the pelts on the wall as well. That's a fringe Hall of Fame player. That's got an amazing pedigree and equity and everything else. And he'd be the only one. But I think Dwayne wants his money and wants his extension, and that will be priority more than anything that Russell said to Dan Patrick and in the off season. But I will say, if you ever do see any of it, if Russell holds the ball and takes a sack, who's going to be the one to say something? Dwayne. And we've seen that at times already. We've seen a little verbal exchange here and there. And you know what? I don't think that will be unhealthy. I think that could be actually a redeeming, healthy environment and factor.
Well, you're a little more positive about it than I am. I maybe it's nothing, and I hope that it's nothing, and I hope that everything just kind of, this is past all this, and it was just, off-season chatter that didn't mean anything. But I'll have my eye on it for sure, because anytime a quarterback said, especially Russell's never really said anything like that, mm-hmm. decides, and he's not very good at it. For all the things Russ is good at, he proved not to be very good at this, because he's not Aaron Rodgers. He's not comfortable being a jerk.
Well, Russ and Mark Rodgers.
Neither of them are good at this.
Correct.
Right? I mean, so you just kind of, maybe it means nothing, and maybe Dwayne Brown, the rest of the O-line's like, yep, it's totally fine. And once they get all back together, they talk it through and there's no issues. But I will be a little worried about that one. And then that leads me to number six. This is my bonus one. It's not quite a full storyline or anything to watch, but what is Bobby Wagner's future with the Seahawks?
Mm-hmm.
Because he's getting huge money. He's playing well, mostly, but not necessarily at the level of the money he's being paid. And that's not a shot at Bobby. Bobby's great, and I love the guy. But if he doesn't have a monster year and do so without his buddy KJ next to him for the first time,
yeah.
Is he a candidate to not be on this team next year?
Yeah, you make $18 million a year now, you're going to be a candidate, right? We see this all the time with cap casualties. And, I mean, this is the trade-off of signing monster mega market-setting deals, is you've got to be pretty unique.
Well, and you're going to, but you also, I mean, if you're the Seahawks, you're going to have to sign Jamal Adams to huge money. You mentioned DK Metcalf's going to want his money. Like, there's some big contracts coming up for these guys.
Yep. You got to extend Dwayne Brown. Diggs on the back end at safety wants a little bit of dough. So, yeah, now the cap does grow. There is opportunity there. But, yeah, I would think if I'm Bobby Wagner, now business is business, and you've watched your peers around you in the entire Legion of Boom, and you're the last one kind of standing, and at this number, it's a year-by-year proposition.
Well, and you saw them draft Jordan Brooks in the first round last year.
Correct.
So, hey, Bobby, cause some turnovers this year. Make some big third and one stops.
Just be violent, man. And that gets harder to do, right, at this stage of the career, right? It's like watching an old man play racquetball. They know all the angles. You watch the young buck expend all sorts of energy, wants to hit it really hard, and then he kind of got the old sage gray hair that knows all the angles off the wall.
Just like racquetball. Is that something you're watching a lot? Oh, yeah, just go down to the racquetball court and watch
Olympics.
Some old guys play.
It's like kind of similar to squash.
I watched some badminton.
Oh?
Yeah.
A little shuttlecock?
Yeah.
What's going on out there? Pretty quick.
Yeah, they move pretty quick.
Yeah, watch a little table tennis. So
that's too quick.
Goodness,
that's
how do you
too
react
quick.
That fast? It's amazing.
Yeah, table tennis is too quick. You have enough time with badminton, because it kind of goes up high in the air sometimes.
Sometimes. man, that thing comes at you fast when they smash that.
they smash it into the net a lot, though. By the way, the smash isn't always a good idea.
One Olympic sport that probably should be banned is men's indoor volleyball. Have you seen how hard those guys hit the ball?
Violent.
Unreal.
Yes. What's with the guy who wears the wrong color jersey on the court?
It's the Lavolo or something.
Yeah, Libero.
Libero. Yeah, Terry Lavolo.
Nicholas Ladero.
Can he only... It seems like that guy doesn't go near the net.
They're like a rover.
But they can't go near the net, right?
Digs and sets.
It just digs and sets.
I think it sets.
Yeah, that's what I think.
Yep.
That's what I got out of watching it. The best thing I've seen suggested for the Olympics is that the triathlon should, instead of being the three, like instead of being running, swimming, biking, they should at random choose three sports out of a hat and from the people that are already at the Olympics, name three triathletes who have to perform in these three sports.
You have no idea
what's coming. Like archery, golf, swimming. Go.
It's like an even better. I mean, we get a little of that with like the decathlon or the heptathlon.
Right.
Like, all right, you're competing in a litany of. Now, these ones could just be from all over the board.
From anywhere. All right, water polo,
kayaking,
judo, and crew. I mean, like, could be anywhere. I think that'd be fun.
I'd be all in. That would truly be the world's greatest ever.
You would watch that, wouldn't you?
Yes.
What the heck out of that right there? So
this man has never held a gun. He is now skeet shooting. Here we go.
I think it'd be really funny. That would definitely make the Olympics a little better. Told you, man. We had a ton to get to, so we'll see if we can kind of finish this up here. But I did want to tell you a quick story because I'd be curious how you would have reacted in this moment, okay? I'm downstairs, just in my main floor. Heather's upstairs, and she's about to get in the shower. She kind of yells down. She goes, "Hey, did you throw something black in the toilet?"
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, well, man, there's a couple ways to answer this, but I was like, no, I mean, like, I generally flush, but sometimes it's been backing up. She's like, no, it's not that. I'm like, okay. She's like, just come take a look. I'm like, I'm eating some ice cream too, but I was like, now I feel kind of grossed out.
Is this at the point that your girls are gone too? So it's kind of unreasonable that there would be something strange.
They were home, but I just, okay. So I put down my ice cream, which now does not seem appetizing to me at all. And I head upstairs, and she's in the shower, and she's like, "Yeah, just look in the toilet." So I open the lid to the toilet, and there's a gigantic, like, not, I don't mean like, just like it's sort of taking up the entire water area at the bottom, is all black, like a black mass
water?
Of some sort.
Whoa.
Well, I wasn't sure. It looked like there was a solidity to it. It was opaque. I couldn't see.
Please tell
it.
Me it was not a snake.
It was definitely, oh my God, dude.
He wouldn't be here.
He wouldn't be living in that house. Would be burned to the ground.
We would have burned the house. I would have called Matt Hasselbeck, asked what he did when he was living in Nashville, and just burned that thing to the ground. So Heather's like, no, look at it. I was like, I think there's lace on it. She's like, what? That doesn't make any sense. Like, she's like, use the toilet brush and kind of move it around and see what it is. Like, okay. So I take the toilet brush out, right, for cleaning, and I kind of start moving it. I'm going,
stirring
it around. Like, ah! Of course, I jump back and pretend like something is happening. Ah! And Heather's like, what? What is it? I'm like, it's your underwear. What? She's like, what? I'm like, yeah, that's a pair of your underwear that you have somehow thrown into the toilet.
How?
She's like, I didn't do that. I was like, well, someone did. It wasn't the kids. They were downstairs. Like, what are you talking? Why did you throw your underwear in the toilet? She's like, I don't know. She's like, will you take it out? I'm like, no.
Not my underwear.
That's 100% your job to now remove your underwear from the toilet. Why was it in there?
What happened? Now I could see, like, it's 6 a.m. You're groggy. You're just right. Like things. You put the cereal back in the fridge, you know, the sort of.
Done that.
Yeah.
Did she get up in the middle of the night and do it? Did Wendell participate?
Get in the shower and you throw your clothes? And
I guess. But she doesn't do that. I mean, it's Heather. She's pretty careful about what she does. All I know is she somehow threw her underwear straight into the toilet.
Did she try to flush, do you know?
Thankfully, no.
Good.
No. But good. I think she did start to pee and then was like, ah,
whoa,
there's something in there. So, anyway, I've never seen anything quite like that. I thought I would ask you guys if you have any experience with anything like that. No?
I've never put anything in the toilet that doesn't belong there.
Same. But my wife apparently is acting like a 3-year-old kid and throwing her underwear in there.
Did you do that?
Yeah,
Mike, why did you do that?
She's accusing me of doing it. No, I don't know if I would say that. Mm. I don't know that that's the term I would
use.
Soggy
in a toilet.
Yeah.
It's kind of unappetizing.
I mean, I know that there's a lot of kinks out there. That's not mine. So no. I gotta tell you, there's nothing. Nope, it wasn't the word I would use.
All right.
Anyway, I just thought I would ask. I wasn't sure. I like that. I threw your underwear in the toilet. Sure. That's something I would do.
I thought it'd be so funny.
Why would I possibly do that?
Gotcha.
And am I going to clean it up? No. I'm definitely not going. You get the rubber gloves and deal with that. I'm not going in there. Jeez. Not my problem.
You know what one of my great fears is, by the way, along those lines, is when I'm in the airport, as I've been a time or two here, is now that I wear my readers around my shirt, you know, up top, mm-hmm. and you have your readers, are you ever nervous? Because I am. Like lean over and my readers go into the toilet.
I worry about that with sunglasses too, especially like we go for a hike or something and then you have to use like one of the like outhouses. A pit of despair out by some place in North Bend or whatever. And I'm always like, yeah, hold on tight to those things because if it goes in there, it's toast.
No coming back.
Yes, I do share some of that fear, man. I'm right there with you. What we haven't really had a chance to talk since the expansion draft for the Kraken. Obviously, I've been kind of deeply invested and involved in the whole thing, but I am curious as for you guys, three hockey newcomers, essentially. I know that Kyle and Brock and I have been to a couple of games together in Phoenix. I hope you saw your guy.
There was
Ekman
some relation
Larson.
To Shane Doan, right?
Yeah, well, Ty Doan. No.
They drafted someone that was Shane Doan's cousin.
Oh, I didn't know that.
The kid from Abbotsford, BC.
Yeah. Well, I thought you might have noticed that Matthew Ekman Larson was traded this past week. He's a guy we would always watch in Phoenix. But as newcomers-ish to this game, what did you guys think as you took it all in?
Gosh, I was just trying to decipher how much Mike Salk and the other hockey aficionados loved what the Kraken did. That's a position I was in. I don't know these guys. I don't know their talents. I don't know. You know.
Did you find yourself like reading about them, trying to learn about who the guys were?
I did.
Or was it just like, all right, we've got guys. Okay.
I did. It was honestly, more than anything, it was, gosh, I hope they do something unique. I mean, I hope they do something outside the box. I just want to hear analysis like, wow, they really, you know, a little bit like Vegas did years ago and leading up to that draft and leading up to the expansion draft we talked about on that podcast, right? Man, all the different moves and trades and horse trading and deals cut behind the scenes. And I was just, that I guess was my feeling going in or my hope going in was, man, when it's all said and done and the dust settles and what an amazing 72 hours it's going to be for these guys when the dust settles, I hope hockey experts and analysts go, wow, man, I didn't see that coming. Mm. And I can't believe they were able to get that done. And not to be Debbie Downer, Mr. Negative, but it felt like the rest of the league didn't cooperate the way they did 4 or 5 years ago.
There is some of that. And we don't know. I mean, none of those trades that I told you about happened, right? They didn't make any side deals. No one paid them to take players that they didn't want. So
is that a collective, we don't know. The rest of the league saying, yep, you got me once, you're not going to get me again.
It could be some of that. It could be that Ron Francis was too aggressive. And because of it, he wasn't able to make some of the deals that he asked for the moon. And because of it, he wasn't able to get anything. You know, there's some guys that he could have taken that have since been traded for picks, right? Like he could have taken, Jake Bean, I think is his name, in Carolina. And instead he took a guy out of Carolina that I don't think will make the team. Maybe he will. But that guy got traded for a 4th-round pick a few days later. Why not take the guy, trade him for a 4th-round pick?
Yeah.
Right. So there's like a couple of those options. I'm pretty sure the kid who just got dealt the defenseman for 2 first-round picks, I think that's also a guy they could have taken. Brandon Dillon. If I'm not mistaken. So, look, there have been some opportunities that are sort of surprising they didn't do it in order to sort of benefit their
okay,
their
so when you were sitting
capital.
There and you were covering the expansion draft, right, and you were sitting there working with Stelton, was this a sitting there at the Seahawk facility when Bruce Irvin was drafted? Like, huh?
No.
What?
No, it wasn't James like that. Carpenter? It was kind of in between. It was definitely not James Carpenter. No, it wasn't.
Who
that.
Who is this?
I think I look at it, Brock, and we still don't know how this is all going to play out. They're either geniuses or doofuses. I think this is either a genius draft or a doofus one. Because they did draft some good players. They spent very little money and got very few great players. And they got a ton of defensemen, like more than they need, more than they could keep on the roster. but they don't have enough forwards and especially guys who can score.
And they still have an abundance of cap space.
Yeah, so what's going to happen with that cap space? It's a flat cap situation in the NHL. So unlike the NFL, which is growing, the NHL was flat unexpectedly. And so all these teams that have these longer-term contracts that get, you know, more and more as they get old, well, they're going to need to get rid of players because they can't afford to keep them all. So there may be some very good, slightly expensive players that are available for them to take on the salary of because they have that ability. But it's also possible, and I don't know this for a fact, this is just speculation, it's possible they're just cheap. It's possible they're not going to spend. It's possible that the building this arena and everything else cost more than anybody thought, and they don't have the extra $30 million. Now, I don't think that's the case. I want to be really clear. I think that they are going to do the former. I think they're going to now use their available cap space to help build this thing even better than it is right now. But you have to at least allow for the possibility that we don't know anything about this organization yet, and it could be cheap. I'd give that about a 10% out of 100% chance, honestly. I'd say it's about 90% that they handled this really well, and they're now going to be able to do what they want to do. But
I mean, Bruckenheimer's not been able to make a movie lately.
That's true. Here's the other possibility, Brock. They played this thing banking on other teams who were going to need to get rid of everybody, and it doesn't happen.
Right.
It just doesn't end up happening, that the teams find more creative ways to handle it under the cap, and they're not able to take full advantage of the situation that they've planned for. Even if all those things happen and it doesn't work out the way we want, they still got a team that's kind of fun. Like, it's not a great team because they just don't have enough scoring, and it looks like they're adding some guys. I think Jaden Schwartz will help. He's a center who they're going to add from St. Louis here. So they'll find some guys that will help. But they've got some really fun dudes on this team that I think you're going to like a lot.
And a ton of defenders.
They've got a lot of defensive guys. But
goalie? You like the goalie move?
Yeah, I do. I like him. It was the right move. It was better than taking Carey Price, which was going to be too expensive. There's a few guys I think you'll really like, Brock. You're going to love Brandon Tanev. You're going to love him.
Is that the guy with the big eyes?
Yeah, crazy eyes. Tom Murphy guy.
Yeah.
He's like run around. He has led his team the last few years in hits taken, and block shots. That's a dude who's willing to pay the price physically in order to help the team.
They keep the stat on hits taken.
Yes. Huh? Yeah, and here's the reason why, if you want like a little mini hockey 101 for you, like you'll hear this phrase, one of my favorite hockey phrases said by announcers. It's takes the hit to move the puck. Takes the hit to move the puck. And if you think about it, what are you doing? Like, one of the reasons you hit in hockey is to intimidate people into making a mistake as you're rushing at them and they need to get rid of the puck. Well, if you're willing to stand in there like a quarterback who's willing to get hit as he throws the ball deep down the field, how many times do we praise the quarterback for standing strong, standing tall in the pocket, looking down the receiver to the last possible moment, getting drilled in the chin? Well, that's what you do in hockey. If you're willing to take the hit to move the puck, you can be a really effective player just through your strength and courage.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to like Tanev. He hits guys, and he doesn't mind getting hit. And, oh, by the way, he gets in front of 102-mile-an-hour shots. Like, that's a guy who's willing to pay the price physically. That's a dude you're really going to like.
And that was a priority for them, obviously.
It sure seemed to be.
Yeah.
You're going to love Giordano. I mean, he's just a captain. Like, just a straight-up captain. You're going to love the leadership.
How much did you love just sitting there talking about
it? Oh, my God. I was so happy. I love this.
Come on.
Did you happen to watch the video of this kid, Curtis McDermott, that I tweeted out? Is there any chance you watched this guy fight?
No.
He's the Kings defenseman they got. Dude, please go watch this video.
Okay.
He beats the tar out of people. Like, all of the fights in it, they had two things in common. One, he doesn't just fight, he wins them decisively.
He finishes.
Yes. And two, it seemed like almost all the fights came because he drilled somebody leading to the fight. Like, he was a clean, legal, hard check, and then someone got mad and wanted to come fight him. And he's like, okay, let's go. And then he beats the tar out of them. I like that guy.
in summation, as you look at their group right now, and it's incomplete. There's still some work to be done. But in summation, if you were to define what their plan was, right, in end game, you know, this roster as it sits and composed
today. I think it was to have flexibility both of position and monetarily, financially moving forward, and to draft a group that was going to play really physical, defensive. Yeah, play with a little sandpaper.
Mm-hmm. Brock, these are the things Mike's been teaching us, some terminology.
You're going to play with a little sandpaper.
They play with a little sandpaper. They got some grit. They play rough.
Yeah, they'll do some mucking in the corners. Absolutely. They'll do a little bit of mucking.
Gio Darno, he's good in the room.
They'll play with jam.
Yeah.
You like that one?
Play
a little jam.
That's what I was trying to think
of. Yeah, they'll play with some jam. Yeah. But all those things are going to be true of this team. Those are the kind of guys they took. They're not superstars. They got some dudes. Jordan Eberle's a dude, and Gord's a dude, Larson's a dude, Alexiak's a dude. Like, they got some guys on this team, and they've got some upside breakout potential guys, and McCann, and Appleton, and Yarncroke. You like Marshawn getting Yarncroke's name during
the game? Callie, my boy Callie.
Your boy Callie. Your boy, Marshawn. Boy Callie.
Who was Eddie Lacy, Marshawn Lynch, were you or confused Sean at all?
Sean Kemp is three
Sean
of them.
Another
right. Four of them.
Brock. I think we can definitively say Marshawn's not making another comeback. Right? Are we good on that now? Marshawn's done. He gave the one comeback. He's done.
He always did those D-line drills.
Yeah.
Maybe a little three technique.
I think he might be done, but God, is he the best, isn't he? How funny was that?
That's amazing. That's exactly what I wanted from Marshawn.
Boy Callie.
Boy Callie, though.
Boy Callie.
He nailed it. So anyway, yeah, I do like what they did, Brock. I
didn't love it. I
can't quite say love. There were some other guys out there that, but they must have decided if the person doesn't fit exactly what we want, we're not going to spend the money. So if, you know, Van Riemsdyk was out there, who's a proven veteran scorer, who was going to make some money, who they could have afforded and taken from Philly because they took basically no one from Philadelphia. They just decided he wasn't worth it.
Mm-hmm.
So they must have really stuck to their guns on guys they didn't want to take, which is fine. As long as they then spend that on other guys that they truly do want, and we'll wait and see over the next few weeks whether or not they do that.
Well, I'd heard that there might be some thinking that they've got a lot of guys who are on expiring contracts this year that potentially they could be positioning themselves to. This year's about set the culture with your young core, and next year's about set spend to really add to that group and set the future.
They maybe didn't have the same level of talent available to them as Vegas did. The draft this year was not as good as next year's is going to be, although I really like their Matty Beniers pick. It's a really good pick with the second pick in the draft. So, yeah, that may very well be it. They weren't in exactly the same spot as Vegas. The other thing to think about is that every team in the NHL is now 131st worse than it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, you've grown the league. When you expand the league, each your expectation of how good your team is has to go down by a very small amount. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's another, like, you've taken a good player off of every
another
team.
Roster.
You've mm-hmm. diluted. Yeah. And that's happened twice now in the last 5 years. So your expectation of what a good team is now, what, 1/16th lower than it used to be. That's worth thinking about also when you think about their team and where they're going. Does that help at all?
A little bit.
I'm still pumped, though, man.
I know you are.
I'm really excited about this. They're going to be fun. It's going to be fun to be there. The jerseys look good. The whole, like, it's going to be good. And from what I've heard from people working inside the arena, it's going to be done, and it's going to look sweet when it's all set. So
let's go.
It's gonna be pretty fun. Give me a next couple weeks here, man. Between the trade deadline, training camp, cracking, continuing to sign guys, this is about as good as it gets right now, Brock. This is awesome.
I love it. Get a little sleep. All right,
I'll do my best. It's good to talk to you today, buddy. We'll do it again next week. Until then, the hang
barn.
See everybody.
Get to the chopper.